the far reaches of the galaxy.
Oh, what is it?
Steve Oteo in the AM brings you Theology Thursday with Pastors Brian Nixon.
Steven.
Get your questions in at studio@star88.fm.
That was terrible.
That wasn't very good, guys.
Terrible. I tried, man. I just feel so left out. It's like Jared Beecher hasn't been here in a century, but whatever.
I'm still on.
That's what I got paid to do this.
You're the guy who has his own podcast now, the Art Collective. You've got your own.
You've had such famous guests as me.
No, and hey, listen, my first episode went up on iTunes yesterday.
John Mark McMillan.
Yeah. Not a bad first podcast, so leave the Art Collective alone.
Yeah. No, I
pretty
know.
Cool.
It's good.
It's
good.
No problem. I had a podcast. We had guests, including, like Alicia Silverstone.
Yeah.
What?
See, who else?
Benedict Cumberbatch.
I talked to George Washington.
Yeah.
Talked
dude, it was
to
great.
What is this podcast?
The
podcast in my head.com?
Imagination Land is what I call it.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so great. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So we have a great Theology Thursday
for
this particular edition.
Yeah.
And Steve-O, you and I were privileged to be talking with Terry Glaspie before we went on air, and we really think this is going to be a fun broadcast.
Yeah, it's going to be a hoot, as you say.
What?
That guy, he's 60, so what? He says words like hoot.
Hootenanny.
It's going to be a good time. We're really excited. Terry Glaspie, author. He's got his MA at the University of Oregon.
That's master's.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sweet. He's an avid student of intellectual and cultural history. He lectures on issues related to the relationship between art and faith. Author of several books, including the Epical Medallion Finalist, A Tame Lion, The Book Lover's Guide to Great Reading. He served on the board of directors for the Society of Research and Education on Church History, also known as Search, and he lives in Eugene, Oregon. Give a shout out to Terry Glaspie, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, Terry.
Hey.
How did you like that introduction?
Good, right?
That could have probably been one of the worst introductions you've received.
Dang.
But that.
I'm just really curious to see what I'll say after that. Really.
I feel like you just need to come out strong. You know, like maybe
use words we don't know.
Bottled water and spit the water out of your mouth, and then hit somebody with a folding chair
because
it was like a WWE entrance.
Do it.
It was fantastic.
Was it?
Speaking of high art, entertainment wrestling.
Yeah.
Oh,
Terry, as you could tell, this is a very free-flowing, loose Theology Thursday radio broadcast.
Not loose theology, just loose lips.
Oh, man, just you can
loose,
get in, everybody, for fun. You
we,
get to
we
heaven.
We have a lot of fun.
You get to heaven.
We try to make theology and heady topics fun, as you could tell.
Oh, man.
Yeah, man.
But, hey, can we get serious here for a minute?
Yes.
Because Terry, really, you've written a wonderful book called 75 Masterpieces Every Christian Should Know, which Steve-O said. And in this book, you unpack for us 75 cultural, what I'll call, events or icons that every individual you're claiming should know. And so my first question for you is, you know, with all this art, music, literature, and film that's out there, how did you narrow your choice down to 75?
Well, first of all, I did it very painfully because a lot of my favorites got left out of the book. I could easily do another book that would be another 75. In fact, just for fun, I've been working on such a list. But what I really wanted to do in the book is kind of give the idea, number one, that art is not just something for the cultural elite, you know? Mm. We have that kind of feeling, I think, sometimes that art isn't something that really connects with me, maybe. That this is something that's done in concert halls and art museums. And what I wanted to do is bring it down to the level where everybody could see really what art can do for us and how it can speak to us. And so then I set out to say, okay, well, the other thing I really want to do is I want to help people understand that as Christians, we have an amazing heritage in the arts. I mean, for a lot of people, you know, Christian art is like, well, Amy Grant's early albums, maybe, as far back as they can go.
Sure.
and yet we have this amazing heritage. And so I wanted to show a little bit about that heritage, and I also wanted to show the diversity within the heritage. The fact that all kinds of genres, all kinds of art, all kinds of music, all kinds of literary forms have had Christians right there at the forefront.
Mm. And Terry, you know, I think it's really quite appropriate because yesterday and today, the National Book Awards were given out. And as I was listening to all the winners of the poetry and fiction and literature, you know, one of the authors said, you know, art is for such a time as this. And what they meant is that, you know, in the midst of tragedy, in the midst of so many things going on around our globe, art brings us together as human beings. It's a creative act whereby we are recognizing and, in a sense, realizing, whether we know it or not, that we're made in the image of God. Mm. You know, we're co-creators in something beautiful or thought-provoking. So I think this discussion happening today is really appropriate in light of everything. Because, you know, when there's darkness in the world, the best thing we could do is light a candle. And I think art lights candles like nothing else. So
I totally agree with you on that. And I also was struck by a book I just finished reading, actually yesterday, by Mako Fujimura,
yep,
who is a painter who's actually represented in the
Culture
book.
Culture Care.
I love Godzilla.
And he's got a new book out called Culture Care.
Yep.
And one of the things he was talking about is the fact that artists are kind of the border crossers.
Yep.
They, you know, we tend to build all these walls between different groups of people, between different theologies, between different politics, and oftentimes it's the artists who kind of work back and forth across the borderlands. And especially, I think, in my book, what I wanted to highlight is that borderland between the believer and the non-believer.
Mm.
And that art becomes a really effective way of making that a conversation and not just two camps yelling at each other, mm-hmm, you know?
Yeah.
Which is oftentimes what we're really good at in our culture.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Terry, this is Stephen, and you know, reading through your book, I saw that John Coltrane, A Love Supreme, that by far was my favorite work in the book. Mm-hmm. What was your favorite piece, and which one did you find most inspiring?
Well, that is such a hard question. That is a little bit like asking which of my children I like.
Mine is my third. Today's his third birthday, and he's absolutely my favorite. So it's,
okay,
I just don't understand
then.
That.
A birthday present, I mean, right?
Let's be honest. We all have favorites.
No, we don't.
No, we don't.
Well, the interesting thing I think about art and favorites is that different pieces of art have been my favorites at different times.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, there was a time in my life when a certain Bob Dylan album just touched me at a deep, deep level because of what I was going through in my life. At another time, a Chagall piece, a painting, I couldn't look at it often enough. Rembrandt's Return of the Prodigal Son, I actually have that hanging in my bedroom, and I just oftentimes will look at that and just be reminded of God's love. So that's a real favorite. Yeah, it's like it's really hard to pick any one, and I think every book, every piece in the book is a book or is a piece which at one time or the other has really meant something to me, and they all are works I can continue to come back to, and to me that's one of the definitions of a masterpiece. It's a work. A lot of art, like a really nice song you might hear on the radio, you listen to it two, three, four times. By the fifth time, you've pretty much gotten everything out of it that's there, and you're ready to move on. A masterpiece you can return to throughout your life.
Yeah. So here's a question I have for you as we talk about ingesting different art forms and how they invoke certain emotions. Has there ever been a piece that has been so powerful for you that you have not been able to return to it because of maybe a negative effect it's had? Because I know there are, you know, in high school there's like those records where you're like, I'm never listening to that again, high school girlfriend. Does it work that way with art as well? And are there pieces for you as a Christian that you're like, I cannot take part in this artwork because it makes me think of A, B, and C? But are there any masterpieces that for you just turn away and go, nope, not for me, sorry?
That's an interesting question, and I don't know that I have a very definitive answer to that. I would say that there are certain works of modern art, like for example Francis Bacon. Some of his paintings are so disturbing, and they actually kind of are about the decline of humanity. Human beings are kind of portrayed almost as though they were just meat in his paintings, and they're very disturbing.
Yeah.
And so I don't get any joy out of looking at those, and it's not something I'd want to look at again and again. And yet, in one sense, I'm not sorry I've seen it, in that it helps me understand how some of my fellow human beings are looking at and understanding life, which I think is helpful for the dialogue about faith that happens. And also, I mean, I think any kind of human expression is worth at least giving a little attention to, because there are oftentimes universal kind of truths embedded in it, even if it's not telling the whole truth, or even if it may even be kind of distorting the truth in a certain sense, and yet we can maybe understand the truth more deeply by working through our understanding of how that distorts.
Yeah, great
okay,
insight.
Okay, I got real academic.
No,
real...
that was good.
No, that's, I mean, that's what we're looking for.
Let me ask you a question. You know, were there any masterpieces with Christian influences that when you discovered them, you were like, wow, I didn't know that there was either a Christian worldview or that, you know, it was produced by a Christian. Were there any surprises as you were, you know, gleaning the 75 topics you chose?
Yeah, I discovered a lot of great art that I was not aware of. An African American painter, Henry Ossawa Tanner, is somebody whose work I discovered by seeing one painting of the Annunciation, where the angel comes to Mary to tell her that she's going to give birth to Jesus. It so stopped me in my tracks that I actually, as soon as I got away from the museum, I got on my computer to find out more about him, and found out that he had done a number of biblical paintings and that his faith was really important to him.
Hmm.
Another example would be Jane Austen, who, you know, I'd heard that her father was a pastor in the Anglican Church, and I thought, okay, well, I should look a little more deeply because I've always enjoyed her books, but there's not much directly about faith in her books. But there's a lot of really good stuff there. And so as I did more research and got into reading some biographies about her life, I kept coming across these references to these prayers that she had written for her family devotions. And when I did a little more research and found those prayers, and in fact, I've released those prayers as a little book now called The Prayers of Jane Austen, they were so beautiful and so powerful and so honest and confessional.
Mm.
And so it's like I understood Jane Austen in a completely new way when I went back and looked at her novels again, because I saw the faith shining through in ways I hadn't noticed it before.
Hmm.
So lots of kind of experiences like that as I studied. I would find that people had a lot more depth to their faith often than I had ever guessed.
Man, I'm so glad we're talking about this, because this is exactly the purpose of Theology Thursday, and a big part of why we love working here is this conversation of how we as Christians take in art. And so I know with modern art, or with I guess we would call it folk art, right? As we talk about music in the Christian sense, it's like, here's a quote unquote Christian artist, so I can ingest this because I know for a fact that Mercy Me loves Jesus, so I'm gonna listen to that, but I can't take in that Coltrane record or the Bob Dylan that you're discussing because it's not overtly Christian. Let's talk about this, breaking it down more into layman terms, if you will, because I'm an idiot. How do we as Christians, how should we ingest art, and how can we, even though at times, as you're talking about these artists or these pieces that just rock your world, and it's not until later that you discover, oh, this person has faith. How do we engage in art in this culture that's kind of divided with whether or not we should even be partaking?
Well, I guess that would be my starting place is to say that by refusing to partake of any art, music, and literature that's not Christian, which is, in a sense, mostly what's represented in my book, but mm-hmm. I would say if that's all we're willing to ingest or say that we're willing to ingest, I think we rob ourselves of just some beauty that we could bring into our lives, some insight that we could bring into our lives. You know, the old saying is all truth is God's truth, and God often chooses very unlikely candidates to be the people who bring forth some of the most beautiful art and literature. I mean, one of the interesting things I learned as I did the research for this book is how many of these people were people who were strugglers. Mm. You know, the artist, I think, sometimes is a person with a little more sensitive antenna to all of life, and sometimes that makes their life just a little bit more difficult to maneuver through. And so a lot of these great artists are people who are struggling. They're, as you know, Mako Fujimura would say, they're people who are they're border crossers. You know, they're crossing the border between faith and doubt and helping us to understand what the real human experience is like.
Yeah.
Now, I think I just totally got off the track of what your question was.
No, it's fine.
Not at all.
Steve doesn't even remember what he asked anyway, so
stop
it's fine.
It is Theology Thursday. On the phone, author Terry Glaspie. We discussed his book a few weeks ago, actually, when we were talking about art. 75 Masterpieces Every Christian Should Know. And if you'd like to get in a question, facebook.com/star88FM. That's facebook.com/star88FM. You can give us a call, 338-3700. Steven, I know you had something.
Yeah, so some of the masterpieces in your book, such as U2, Amberlin, or Bob Dylan, may surprise modern readers, but could you tell us a little bit about them?
Wait, Terry.
Throw your band
Terry,
in the mix with Terry, you and Bob.
He just did a sleight of hand.
Yeah, what? No, man. It's in the book.
Steven was
75 masterpieces
of all of them.
Everybody who's awesome should know. It's part two. You guys haven't read it yet. Part two.
Because
poor Terry.
Says that's
he's not in the studio with us. He doesn't know how goofy this
Gosh.
Is. Terry,
but
Steven
I do have
was the singer for Amberlin, and he did the sleight of hand by putting in.
There's no
YouTube
sleight of hand. He knows.
You don't have to totally.
No, but I do have a serious question.
Well, you know, the truth is there were actually originally 76 masterpieces in Amberlin 1.
Praise him. Praise
him.
For editorial reasons,
man.
We had to cut
I totally
so
understand.
Sorry.
No. Publicists, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Right.
Publishers. No, I do have a sincere question, though. I would like to know a little bit more of like post Bob Dylan salvation and kind of can you tell me, because I'm really curious to know as far as like his salvation, his conversion experience, and then how it influenced his work after he was after he found Jesus.
That's a really fun question, and I'll have to be careful here because I could just really go off on that because I've
no, please. No, I'm excited.
But
it's an hour program. We got to fill it some way. Right. I mean, might as well talk about stuff that doesn't suck.
Yeah. in Dylan's, from the very start of Dylan's career, you will find a lot of references to Bible characters and biblical events. It's really interesting. If you go back to even his very, very earliest kind of folk, just straightforward folk music. And at that point, I think his Jewish heritage was part of what, you know, made that come to the fore with him. And then, as we all know, in the late 70s, you know, Dylan had a very profound conversion experience. He met Jesus, and for about 2 or 3 years, he put out a series of albums that were just, fiery evangelistic albums, just laying everything out on the line. And in some ways, I think some of his poetry sort of suffered during that period because he was so intent on getting the message across that you didn't get some of that typical cleverness that you would have gotten on earlier Bob Dylan music. I would argue that after, you know, the three really straightforwardly Christian albums he did, at that point he like had made his statement about faith. in the most kind of confrontational almost kind of way that he could. And then he began to, keeping that Christian worldview, still begin to build in now a more oblique, a more subtle way of talking about life, seeing it through the grid of his Christian faith, but not singing necessarily as much about the Christian faith.
Yeah, I found it interesting, Terry, that you did put Infidels as one of the masterpieces, because I think most Christian books would have put, let's say, Shot of Love or Slow Train to Come In. Mm-hmm. But when I was flipping through this, I was fascinated, because I went, just like Stephen, you know, obviously our generation, you two, Bob Dylan and such, we gravitate towards, and I thought, huh, you put Infidels. And that was real interesting, and now hearing you out, that explains why.
Yeah, it's kind of a transitional album, I think. It's the album where he begins to return to, instead of talking about faith, now he's talking about all the things he's concerned about again, yet with a biblical worldview showing through. And you know what? Bob Dylan is not a perfect human being. He probably has said and done things that the Christians might not agree with or approve of. But even in interviews in very recent years, he talks about, he said, if you want to understand what I believe about life, he says, go back and listen to the old classic hymns.
Yeah.
He said, that's my theology, the
right.
hymns.
Right. Mm. Yeah, he really is a fascinating character. And interestingly enough, more recently doing artwork, he has a new exhibit that's coming out both in London and in New York. He's doing some steel sculptures and painting. So wow. Bob really is a fascinating character.
So I have questions as we look the top 75 in here, and I'm looking at them, and forgive me, because of course I immediately go film and music, because that's my bend. I love film, so I looked at, you know, Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, and I'm like, that's great, but what about Harvey? Jimmy Stewart's best is probably Harvey. Okay, so what made you choose what you chose as far as like Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis? Is it like, no, this is the peak of his works, or is it just simply because they were great children's stories? How did you pick what you picked?
Okay, well, one thing I want to be really clear about is that this, I am not saying that these are the 75 greatest masterpieces ever created. I'm saying these are 75 masterpieces that will give you a window into the diversity of what Christians should know about their heritage, about their creative heritage.
Perfect. So you're not saying that At Folsom Prison is Johnny Cash's best, when clearly American 3, I'm just kidding.
Oh,
I might actually agree with you on that,
okay.
too.
Okay, see, I'm a huge Johnny Cash fan, so
no,
I saw
sorry.
That and it was like, hey, all right.
Yeah, one of the other things that I was looking for is, I was looking for pieces that had really interesting and revealing stories behind them.
Huh.
Because what this book is not is like, you know, a dry disquisition. Even the choice of the word disquisition, I just realized. But anyway, on what makes up this work of art, and using a lot of lofty language or a lot of technical terms, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to introduce you to the art, and then I wanted to get into the story of the person behind the art and how their faith affected the way that they created and what they produced.
Were there any periods of history where you found that there was a larger emphasis of Christian art, like let's say the Renaissance, or you know, were they
the
just
70s?
Yeah, or the 70s?
What?
Yeah, exactly. Were there any periods in history where you found Christian works to be more prevalent during others?
Well, I think during the Middle Ages, and during the Renaissance period, so much of the art that's created is reflective of biblical themes and theological themes. Some of that has to do with that was by far the dominant worldview of that period of time. I think another reason for that is the whole thing of patronage. If you were an artist trying to make a living, one of the easiest ways to make a living was by painting religious art, because there was a constant need for art for churches and
it's
art
like photographers
where leaders could show
photos.
That they were the spiritual giants they wanted people to believe that they were. And so a lot of that art is very much reflective of, you know, the Christian worldview being the dominant worldview. And so there's a lot of it. But I think what's interesting is as we get more into the modern period where there is not as much a dominant worldview that everybody in the culture agrees upon, I think in a lot of ways the Christian art gets actually in a lot of ways more interesting because it's about communicating to a world that may not embrace faith. In fact, maybe in opposition to faith.
This going right off your question, right? I mean, actually your answer is saying the Renaissance period and all, you know, here it feels like, you know, since then we've been on a decline as far as Christians being in the art community. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that Christians have kind of backed away from the exact expression of creation, which, you know, our God established day one?
Well, I mean, the one thing I would argue is that, yeah, just as part of the whole cultural shift, yes, probably fewer artists are believers than used to be, just like probably fewer firemen are believers than would have been at one point in history. I mean, I think that's just part of our sort of the fleeing from faith. Mm. But I think what's interesting is that the Christians who are artists, as we get more into the modern world, their art usually is partly a really clear upfront expression of their faith, and partly it is allowing their faith just to work through whatever they're painting, whether it be a landscape or whether it be a love song, you know, that the Christian worldview is bigger than just talking about religion and the Bible, that it affects every area of our lives, and therefore through art we are given the opportunity to reflect on every area of our lives. And in fact, a lot of the art is kind of about the struggle of holding on to faith in a world in which it's more of a minority opinion. And I mean, I think that's one of the things that U2 does so well, you know, as a modern group of musicians. They're saying, you know, I believe in the kingdom come, when all the colors will bleed into one, but a reference to the cross and what Jesus has done to them, and then saying, "But I still haven't found what I'm looking for." Right. So it's the tension of saying, like faith doesn't necessarily make life easy. Faith makes life bearable and gives us some a foundation for our lives, but it doesn't make life easy. In fact, sometimes faith makes life harder, and a lot of the artists are really good about showing that.
Yeah. So, speaking of artists and showing that, is that a reason why such brilliant masterminds in the Christian realm, like Thomas Kincaid or Precious Moments,
Amen.
Weren't used? Because I feel like you really did a disservice to both.
I did it. I shortchanged
by not
them.
Yes. Showcasing.
Terry,
Thomas
how many Precious Moments Bibles do you own? We have a listener question.
Okay.
From Facebook. Hi, I'm enjoying this. When it all comes down to what art is in relation to God, creation, redemption, creativity, genius, heartbreak, loss, defeat, victory, etc., what is art? Is it just a visual representation of an experience? Is it an outward and visible manifestation of the inward and invisible longing implanted in each and every one of us? Or is it just what we do on the side as a part of our propensity to create? I always pondered about this. As an artist myself, I try to find my place in this world. Thank you, and God bless.
That
Michael
is a
W. Smith.
Loaded question, loaded question.
Oh, that is so absolutely beautifully expressed.
It is. Yeah, this listener, he's an actual a local artist, and he always comments whenever we talk about faith and art, and he's trying to find that balance, you know. It's very, very important to him, so I bet he would really appreciate your thoughts on it.
Well, and I'm not sure I can give a definitive answer, but I can tell you what kind of the journey that I'm on as far as thinking about all this is that, first of all, I love Tolkien's idea that as artists of any sort, we are sub-creators. God is the creator, and so he is the source of everything that's beautiful and good and true. But he gives us this awesome privilege to be sub-creators who can take the elements of the world in which he has made, rearrange them, and part of that rearrangement is bringing in our personal expression. I don't think art is only about personal expression, but that's a really important part of what it is. And when someone creates a wonderful piece of art, I think ultimately what it does for me as the viewer is it gives me new eyes to see my world and myself and God and the world and the created world around me. I mean, ultimately, one of the most wonderful things that art does is I think it gives us eyes to see, new eyes to see. We live life. I mean, you know, you think about the fact that a lot of art is what I would call fast food art, and just like fast food, I mean, you know, I love an In-N-Out burger or a Chick-fil-A sandwich, but you know, if that is all I ate, I would be missing out on some of the amazing culinary options that are available to me.
Like and Frosted Flakes.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to miss Frosted Flakes. But there's fast food art, and then there's gourmet art.
Nice.
And, you know, if you have a really good gourmet meal, you savor all the different flavors and textures of it, and oftentimes if it's a good enough meal, you're still thinking about that meal and talking about that meal a day or two later.
Yeah, man.
And I think great art is that way. The really truly great art is art that has enough content to it that it affects us.
Yeah.
It changes us.
Let me tag in on that, Terry, because this is something that Steve-O and I were talking about before the broadcast. It's this idea of, you know, gourmet art versus, you know, fast food art. You know, in college, I learned that, you know, the three levels of art. You know, you had the high art, then you had the popular art, and then you had folk art. But you know, your designation's pretty interesting. You know, the gourmet, and you know, related to how we eat and so on and so forth. How would you talk to someone who is saying, hey, bro, my comic book is as great as any Last Supper painting by Leonardo da Vinci? How would you walk them through the process to say, hey, actually, let's sit down and talk about this? I mean, you mentioned earlier on that...
What are the parameters, essentially?
Yeah. What's the matrix?
Labeling it?
Yeah, the matrix. Because you said, you know, great art is what you go back to. But a lot of people will go back to a comic book over and over. So how do you walk through someone to say, hey, this is really gourmet art?
Well, I mean, I think it's very possible for a comic book to be gourmet art. That's not an impossibility.
Alan Moore's Swamp Thing. Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, there we go. I think of a graphic novel I read a few years ago. I think it's by David Thompson called Blankets. Powerful coming-of-age story told as a graphic novel. That was an amazing work of art. I think the Watchmen.
Alan Moore.
Novel,
that's my favorite of all time.
I think it's profound.
Yeah.
And a true picture of humanity. It's more the question of how much has the cook put into the recipe, you know?
Yeah.
That's going to be what makes it either really nourishing or just something entertaining. And I don't think there's anything wrong with just being entertained. I did not want to come across as some sort of cultural snob.
No.
I went and saw the most recent James Bond film. And
no spoilers. Haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, so it was fun.
Awesome.
You know? And it was entertaining. But will I watch that again and again, the way I might revisit some of my favorite albums, some great masterpieces of visual art? No.
Okay. So here's a question. I'm so glad that we're bending this direction, because as we talk about the way we ingested our high art versus masterpieces, masterpieces versus this fast food art, I see the list and I look at a few things and I have a question, and this is a sincere question, and I know it's going to be controversial in the Christian community. 'Cause I I will preface it with this. My first son's name is Jack for a reason. I think C.S. Lewis is brilliant, and what he brought to the table as far as his works were absolutely incredible. When my wife and I got married and I found out she hadn't read The Hobbit by Tolkien, I every night read that to her because The Hobbit is my personal favorite book. I love Tolkien. I love C.S. Lewis. However, where does, and I'm being totally serious, where would Harry Potter fit into this? Because as we talk about high art and we talk about, you know, Chronicles of Narnia and we talk about Lord of the Rings, I would actually place the seven Harry Potter books above both as far as masterpieces, as far as things I would revisit multiple times, as far as the brilliant allegory of Jesus Christ. I would rank that higher than both.
Are you saying that Harry Potter was a Christian series?
Absolutely, I am. And as is Rowling. She said it herself. She did not want to ruin it. And now that it's years removed, it was a direct allegory of Jesus Christ. And she's admitted this herself.
Yeah.
So, why the disclusion of Harry Potter, my friend?
Okay. No, that's a good question.
This has turned into a witch hunt.
Well, you know, because that's what happens. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, I was raised Baptist, and that's wizards and witches, and so, wizards. Oh, really? That's interesting, Lord of the Rings. Tell me more.
Yeah.
So,
let Terry answer your question, bro.
Yeah. I'm curious.
He's got a lot of gotchas he's got to get at.
Okay, we got to get to more of those? Okay. No. I'm going to be completely honest here to tell you that I have, and perhaps I should say this shamefacedly, only read the first of the Harry Potter books, and I have actually watched all the Harry Potter films.
Oh, you ruined it. You ruined it.
So,
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
You should read
No, let me, just so he doesn't feel so bad, no. I've never read one.
Phoenix! See, and
neither
dude,
have I.
Because
I'm a grown man.
Whatever. Oh, yeah, I'm a grown man. Chronicles of Narnia all day. Those books, and I'll tell you, I'm serious. I love C.S. Lewis. Those books don't do it for me. I'm not a huge fan. I've read them once, and I try to get through them with my kids, and I'm like, oh, pass.
Okay.
These are dreadful.
But that's the wonderfully subjective thing about art.
Yes.
I mean, is the fact that sometimes even really great art is not going to be the thing that actually touches your heart very much.
Magicians with you all day long, but past that, it's like, oh.
Yeah, no, I mean, but what I would say is that, you know, a lot of great art, including Rowling's books, a lot of thought, a lot of effort, a lot of work went into them, and you don't want to dismiss them too quickly. And even from the movies, which I realize, you know, you don't want to talk about the movies when they're actually books that can be talked about, but that's all I can do here, is I would agree with you that there is so much that's profound.
Yeah.
In what Rowling is putting across in terms of this redemptive, sacrificial story, in terms of what true friendship looks like,
true
relationships. Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of levels on which there's beautiful things there. Now, yeah, some people will say, I have a friend who's read the Chronicles of Narnia every year. She's like in her 50s, since she was a kid. Every year she reads the Chronicles of Narnia. She loves them. You know, and you're saying, okay, you know, I read them and they're good, fine, but they didn't do as much for me. That's fine. All I say is we should at least give great art an effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if it took the artist a lot of work to create it, maybe it's fair to think that sometimes great art demands something of us. You know, mm-hmm. Lewis says
Good
that
point.
When we, C.S. Lewis says at one point, I think it's an Experiment in Criticism, that we have to have an attitude of receptivity toward art. We have to receive art. We can't, he says, you know, some people just use art for purposes, like for propaganda or entertainment or whatnot, and that even great art can be used that way. And we don't get much out of it. But if we receive art, if we make ourselves a little bit vulnerable, are willing to put in a little bit of work to try to understand and comprehend it, we'll will be rewarded for that.
And I agree with you, Terry. I think great art or gourmet art, high art, however we designate it, really does cause us to think. It causes us to ponder, to analyze, to observe, to come to conclusions. And really, great art also shows us a mirror to our humanity. These are very important things I think you brought out. But to springboard off Steve-O's thing about not including Harry Potter, are there any pieces, music, film, books, or anything that you wish you would have included that weren't included in your 75 top list? What are some obvious ones that should be in that book, but because of space and time that weren't?
Okay, well, just a few thoughts. The mosaics in the city of Ravenna, which were done in the four to six hundred A.D. period, are absolutely amazingly powerful art. But I didn't want to front load the book with too much of early work that would be takes a little more work to access it. The modern composer Arvo Pärt, the Estonian Christian composer.
I will admit. I was very, very surprised you did not include his work. I mean, that was something that I thought, man, 75 masterpieces every Christian should know. Arvo Pärt should be there. Yep.
And that's what's kind of fun about the book is I'll stand behind the fact that every one of these 75 is worth your time and effort to look into and learn the stories behind. But it's only the very tip of the iceberg because there's so many other treasures. I think of the Eisenheim altarpiece, which is in Germany, a late medieval, early Renaissance crucifixion that is just harrowing to look at. It so captures the ugliness and the pain of what we did to Jesus. I'm sad that's not in the book. I'm sad that Mark Hurd isn't in the book. I couldn't put too much music, but I think Mark Hurd was one of the very, very finest Christian artists of our recent days.
Particularly Satellite Sky. Great, great album.
Oh, really? Oh, I've never heard of him.
Oh, great.
Yep. On the phone, Terry Glaspie, author of 75 Masterpieces Every Christian Should Know. Fascinating conversation on Christianity, the arts, how we ingest it, what classifies it. If you have a question, 338-3700 or, of course, facebook.com/star88FM. Tail?
Yeah, let me check this Facebook. I have a question. I just read a book called Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. Have you read that?
I have not.
I think it's interesting because the book... and I know the author's an atheist, and then one of the main protagonists in the book is clearly an atheist, and it even addresses it. It addresses it through the entire book. But the central message of the book is that you can't just live life longing for an escape. You have to actually exist. You have to actually live. That's the central theme of the entire book, which we know, you know, that's like Christianity. That's a big part of it, we're kind of living in a shadow. That's how we view it. And that life abundantly.
Jesus. Hopefully Jesus comes back tomorrow so I don't have to pay that bill.
That life abundantly that Jesus promised is the life that we strive for. And so my question kind of, like, it seems we've talked about how Christians have taken a step back from pursuing the arts as much as they used to. Mm-hmm. Although I do think it's very interesting that you said that artists back in medieval times, it was easier to make money if you were painting in churches. And I kind of parallel that now with like making exclusive Christian art like your Thomas Kincaid
albums.
Or like a lot of Christian music. You know, it's easy to make money, so it's like, go for it. But do you think it's because at some point it's hard to identify that place where you're recognizing things that you don't necessarily take as truth, or you're making idols out of them, and people just don't really know where that line is? Do you think it has something to do with that?
I think that could be part of it. I think there's a little bit of fear that we're, by giving art too much place, that we are denigrating straightforward proclamation. I mean, when you think about it, what makes it art is that it uses subtlety, it moves our emotions in ways that go beyond the purely rational. And, you know, I think a lot of the problem with a lot of Christian art of all kinds these days is it doesn't actually try hard to work as art. It's working as a substitute way of preaching.
It's a very shallow message that anybody can pick up on. And I think you're right with that fear. It's almost like take this Ready Player One. Like, I could, if I want to read this book to my son, I probably wouldn't, because he's a 7 month old and he'd just stare at me. But which would be great. Maybe I should. That would be awesome. He'd just stare at me. But
there's always Good Night Moon. Okay,
that's true.
Yes,
that's true.
Got it memorized.
But you know, like it's kind of like, I could see where people would say, you know, but that's an atheist that wrote that book. How could you read that to your kid? But then it's like, yeah, but if you look deeper, there is a huge message in this that if I approach from a biblical worldview, I can convey that to my kids, and it helps out so much.
I would submit that you talk about common grace, but I know we've got a listener.
Yeah. I wanted to springboard off that too, but...
good to our listeners. They're all calling now.
We'll put a hold on that, because I would love to talk a little bit more about that.
Me too.
Okay. All right. The phone lines are jammed, so let's go out to line one. Hello. Welcome to Theology Thursday. Hello.
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 Hi.
This
is Paul Maxwell calling from Atlanta, Georgia.
What? Hey, Paul Maxwell calling from Atlanta, Georgia. What's up, man?
Not much, man. Love your guys' stuff.
Right.
Thank you, Paul.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Now,
I was going to say, you have a question for Terry?
Oh, yeah. So my question would be, what's the border between artistic creativity and kind of the boundaries of morality in art? I imagine, you know, Christian art isn't like you paint a really great picture and then you kind of paint a little cross in the corner or something like that, right? Christian art is like excellent art, yet where does morality kind of intersect with that? Are the moral boundaries different for a Christian artist, or, you know, kind of something like along that line?
Great question, man.
Great question. And, you know, that's probably every artist individually has to wrestle within themselves about where they're drawing the line and the question, I guess, becomes, what are you trying to evoke in the viewer? You might, as a Christian artist, do something that actually is a little bit shocking, but you're doing it for the purpose to shock, to expose a truth that people need to know, sometimes maybe even about their fallenness. But it's also easy to cross the line where it becomes an attempt to provoke some of our darkest instincts. And I mean, I think there is art that is pornographic in one way or another, and they're all different kinds of ways other than just sex to be pornographic, to take something and use it just to try to get a lurid response from people. And so as an artist, you don't want to do that. But at the same time, I think it's okay at times to be provocative, to be shocking. I mean, art is about telling the truth, and part of the truth about human existence is that we are sinful and fallen creatures in desperate need of redemption by Jesus.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, and I would even say for Paul Maxwell, there's a great art historian and critic. His name is Daniel Seidel.
And he loves his work.
Yeah, he does brilliant stuff, and he really does talk about moral boundaries, and he uses works that, let's say 30 years ago, these were considered taboo, and he really shows them in a new light. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago, and excuse my French here, but there's one called The Piss Christ, and he discusses this in a very...
Christ isn't a bad word. It's cool.
No, I know, but the first word in putting them together. Yeah. But my point is, I would say, hey, Paul, there in Atlanta, get some of Daniel Seidel's books, because they're very, very thought-provoking.
And we will post that on our website, star88.fm, when we post the podcast. We always like to list our resources. Talking more about the idea of, from the artist's perspective, how we can, I guess, quote unquote, cross the line. I'd love to talk about it from the consumer's perspective of art as well, because as we talked, you know, earlier, we're talking Lord of the Rings versus Chronicles of Narnia versus Harry Potter, and I know many Christians who, well, as you're mentioning, people love them. They read Chronicles of Narnia year in and year out. Lord of the Rings, fantastic. Harry Potter has witches, and that is wicked, and the Bible clearly says to stay away from witchcraft. How do we how do we go about consuming it? Because it seems like there's an actual not just divide, but a double standard there as far as, okay, well, this is okay, even though it's the Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe, or, you know, Lord of the Rings with clearly Gandalf, but he's a good wizard. But since this piece of work is about wizards in general, do you know what I'm saying? How do we, as Christians, consume art? What are those boundaries?
I don't know that there are.
No,
I don't
gotta
think
answer it. You got to answer it, Terry. I'm just kidding.
Okay. I don't think. Yeah. I will. Okay. I don't think there are any boundaries that are necessarily the same boundary for everybody.
Okay.
I think that in terms of art. Okay. I think that that your own experiences, your own weaknesses, your own struggles that you might bring to the piece may mean things might not actually be good for you, that may be not detrimental to somebody else. So I don't want to totally write off the fact that people need to use wisdom and discernment about art. But I think that we need to really ask, what is the art trying to communicate to me? How can I receive that? How can I discern what makes sense in it and what doesn't make sense in it? I mean, because art can be so persuasive, and because it can move us at levels beyond just the rational level, it can kind of sneak around our defenses. I think sometimes art, which has, say, an atheistic agenda, can actually have a troubling effect on somebody because they find themselves wrestling with something that they don't know what to do with. So discernment isn't a bad thing, but the one thing I would say clearly on the other side of that is, if you only limit your intake of art to that which is safe and approved, you're really missing out on a lot of what it could offer. You're missing out on a lot of the gourmet meals that are being offered to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Man of Steel, for instance, and the incredible Christology that is Superman. Okay, we are out of time. How does this happen?
What? And there's a person.
Already, I know.
Could they answer it in can they ask a question in 30 seconds?
Let's find out.
Okay,
we'll go to line two.
Line two.
Theology Thursday.
You have 30 seconds.
Ready to go.
So I think the whole idea of not, like, watching certain things like Harry Potter because it has witches in it is kind of silly. Because, I mean, it's like a maturity thing, you know? Like, you watch Chronicles of Narnia, it has witches and magic and all this other stuff, but you won't watch Harry Potter because it wasn't written by C.S. Lewis. And so, like, even with that, if you read, like, Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles, like, that's not very Christian-y, but, like, that was her telling her story of Christianity, of, like, her walk with God.
Yeah.
Through vampire as a metaphor, you know? So
dude,
I think it's just a maturity level.
Yeah, and that's kind of what you were saying, man. Terry, right. Boundaries are not the same for everyone. There's different maturity levels. Some people need milk. Some people could do the meat. Is that correct, Terry?
Absolutely correct. And it's possible to sneak poison into gourmet food, and it's possible to or have ingredients that you might want to eat around.
There you go.
And yet still enjoy the meal.
That's great. Terry, what a privilege having you on the broadcast, and of course for those listeners out there, 75 masterpieces every Christian should know. It's a Baker book. We do have it here in our bookstore at Calvary Albuquerque. You could swing by, or of course get on Amazon or any of those other places.
BakerBooks.com for more information. 75 masterpieces every Christian should know. Terry, thank you so much, dude. Yep. Amazing.
And can I just say, if you're interested in more of this conversation, you can go to my website, TerryGlaspie.com.
Perfect.
I'm blogging about these kind of issues all the time.
Nice.
Awesome. Great. And this broadcast will be podcast. Terry, we'll send you the link so you can link it to your website.
Awesome.
Fabulous. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Bye-bye.
Amazing. If you missed any part of the show, you can download the podcast. It's free. Star88.fm. We'll post the resources, everything at our website, star88.fm. Guys?
Yeah, man.
Awesome. Okay.
Theology Thursday.
Until next time. Steve-O, Teo, everybody. Goodbye.
Theology. Theology Thursday is intended to be an informational, Bible-based discussion on issues and questions that listeners present. Hosts, pastors, and guests attempt to provide reliable, accurate information. If you have additional questions or concerns, please contact the pastoral staff at Calvary Albuquerque.